mother, somebody's grandmother, maybe. We called them Big Mama, and they spoiled us, and you know, you remember. Look at her quilts and broken-down shoes. I know she's somebody's mother because I saw an old breast pump fall into the snow, and she's somebody's grandmother because I saw a card that read, Dear Grandma. But we're law-abiding. I looked into a basket, and I saw some bones, not neck bones, but rib bones, knocking bones. This old couple used to dance. I saw, What kind of work do you do, Father? I called.
I'm a day laborer.
A day laborer. You heard him. But look at his stuff strewn like chitterlings in the snow. Where has all his labor gone? Is he lying?
Hell no, he ain't lying. No, sir.
Then where did his labor go? Look at his old blues records and her pots of plants. They're down home, folks. And everything tossed out like junk, whirled 87 years in a cyclone. 87 years and poof, like a snort in a windstorm. Look at them. They look like my mama and my papa and my grandma and grandpa. And I look like you, and you look like me. Look at them, but remember that we're a wise, law-abiding group of people. And remember it when you look up there in the doorway at that law standing there with his 45. Look at him, standing with his blue steel pistol and his blue serge suit. Or 145, you see 10 for every one of us, 10 guns and 10 warm suits and 10 fat bellies and 10 million laws. Laws. That's what we call them down south, laws. And we're wise and law-abiding. And look at this old woman with her dog-eared Bible. What's she trying to bring off here? She's let her religion go to her head. But we all know that religion is for the heart, not for the head. Blessed are the pure in heart, it says. Nothing about the poor in head. What's she trying to do? What about the clear of head and the clear of eye, the ice water visioned who see too clear to miss a lie? Look out there at her cabinet with its gaping drawers, 87 years to fill them, and full of brick and brack, a bric-a-brac, and she wants to break the law. What's happened to them? They're our people, your people and mine, your parents and mine. What's happened to them? I tell you, a heavyweight yelled, pushing out of the crowd, his face angry. Hell, they've been dispossessed, you crazy son of a bitch. Get out the way. Dispossessed, I cried, holding up my hand and allowing the word to whistle from my throat. That's a good word. Dispossessed. Dispossessed. 87 years. And dispossessed of what? They ain't got nothing. They can't get nothing. They never had nothing. So who was dispossessed, I growled. We're law-abiding, so who's being dispossessed? Can it be us? These old ones are out in the snow, and we're here with them. Look at their stuff. Not a pit to hiss in, nor a window to shout the news, and us right with them. Look at them. Not a shack to pray in or an alley to sing the blues. They're facing a gun, and we're facing it with them. They don't want the world, but only Jesus. They only want Jesus. 15 minutes of Jesus on the rug, bare floor. Huh. How about it, Mr. Law? Do we get our 15 minutes worth of Jesus? You got the world. Can we have our Jesus? I got my orders, Mac, the man called, waving the pistol with a sneer. You're doing all right telling them to keep out of this. This is legal, and I'll shoot if I have to. But what about the prayer? They don't go back. Are you positive? You could bet your life, he said. Look at him, I called to the angry crowd.
with his blue steel pistol and his blue serge suit. You heard him. He's the law. He says he'll shoot us down because we're a law-abiding people. So we've been dispossessed. And what's more, he thinks he's God. Look up there, back against the post with a criminal on either side of him. Can't you feel the cold wind? Can't you hear it asking, what did you do with your heavy labor? What did you do? When you look at all you haven't got in 87 years, you feel ashamed. Tell him about it, brother, an old man interrupted. It makes you feel you ain't a man.
Yes, these old folks had a dream book, but the pages went blank, and it failed to give them the number. It was called The Seeing Eye, the great constitutional dream book, The Secrets of Africa, The Wisdom of Egypt. But the eye was blind. It lost its luster. It's all cataracted like a cross-eyed carpenter, and it doesn't saw straight. All we have is the Bible. And this law here rules that out. So where do we go? Where do we go from here? Without a pot?
We're going after that Patty,
the heavyweight called, rushing up the steps. Someone pushed me.
No, wait, get out the way now.
There was a rush against me and I fell, hearing a single explosion, backward into a whirl of milling legs, overshoes, the trampled snow cold on my hands. Another shot sounded above like a bursting bag. Managing to stand, I saw atop the steps, the fist with the gun being forced into the air above the crowd's bobbing heads, and the next instant they were dragging him down into the snow, punching him left and right, uttering a low, tense, swelling sound of desperate effort, a grunt that exploded into a thousand softly spat, hate-sizzling curses. I saw a woman striking with the pointed heel of her shoe, her face a blank mask with hollow black eyes, as she aimed and struck, bringing spurts of blood running along beside the man who was dragged to his feet now as they punched him gauntlet-wise between them. Suddenly I saw a pair of handcuffs arc gleaming into the air and sail across the street. A boy broke out of the crowd, the marshal's snappy hat on his head. The marshal was spun this way and that, then a swift tattoo of blows started him down the street. I was beside myself with excitement. The crowd surged after him, milling like a huge man trying to turn in a cubbyhole, some of them laughing, some cursing, some intently silent.
The brute struck that gentlewoman, poor thing, the West Indian woman chanted. Black man, did you ever see such a brute? Is he a gentleman, I ask you? The brute, give it back to him, black man. Repay the brute 1,000-fold. Give it back to him unto the 3rd and 4th generations. Strike him, our fine black men. Protect your black women. Repay the arrogant creature to the 3rd and 4th generations.
We're dispossessed, I sang at the top of my voice. Dispossessed, and we want to pray. Let's go in and pray. Let's have a big prayer meeting. But we'll need some chairs to sit in, rest upon as we kneel. We'll need some chairs.
Here's some chairs down here, a woman called from the walk. How about taking in some chairs?
Sure, I called. Take everything. Take it all. Hide that junk. Put it back where it came from. It's blocking the street and the sidewalk, and that's against the law. We're law-abiding, so clear the street of the debris.
Put it out of sight. Hide it. Hide their shame. Hide our shame.
Come on, men, I yelled, dashing down the steps and seizing a chair and starting back, no longer struggling against or thinking about the nature of my action. The others followed, picking up pieces of furniture and lugging it back into the building.
We ought to have done this long ago, a man said. We damn sure should. I feel so good, a woman said. It feels so good.
Black men, I'm proud of you, the West Indian woman shrilled. Proud!
We rushed into the dark little apartment that smelled of stale cabbage and put the pieces down and returned for more. Men, women, and children seized articles and dashed inside, shouting, laughing. I looked for the 2 trustees, but they seemed to have disappeared. Then coming down into the street, I thought I saw one. He was carrying a chair back inside. So, you're law-abiding too, I called, only to become aware that it was someone else. A white man, but someone else altogether. The man laughed at me and continued inside. And when I reached the street, there were several of them, men and women, standing about cheering whenever another piece of furniture was returned.
It was like a holiday. I didn't want it to stop. Who are those people? I called from the steps.
What people? Someone called.
Those, I said, pointing.
You mean those old fays?
Yes, what do they want?
We're friends of the people, one of the white men called.
Friends of what people? I called, prepared to jump down upon him if he answered, you people.
We're friends of all the common people, he shouted. We came up to help.
We believe in brotherhood, another called.
Well, pick up that sofa and come on, I called.
I was uneasy about their presence and disappointed when they all joined the crowd and started lugging the evicted articles back inside. Where had I heard of them?
Why don't we stage a march? One of the white men called, going past. Why don't we march? I yelled out to the sidewalk before I had time to think.
They took it up immediately.
Let's march! Good idea! Let's have a demonstration! Let's parade!
I heard the siren and saw the scout cars swinging into the block in the same instant. It was the police. I looked into the crowd, trying to focus upon their faces, hearing someone yell,
Here come the cops!
And others answering, Let them come!
Where is all this leading? I thought, seeing a white man run inside the building, as the policeman dashed from the cars and came running up.
What's going on here?
A gold shield officer called up the steps. It had become silent. No one answered.
I said, what's going on here? He repeated. You!
He called, pointing straight at me.
We've been clearing the sidewalk of a lot of junk,
I called, tense inside.
What's that?
It's a cleanup campaign, I called, wanting to laugh. These old folks had all their stuff cluttering up the sidewalk, and we cleared the street.
You mean you're interfering with an eviction,
he called, starting through the crowd.
He ain't doing nothing,
a woman called from behind me. I looked around. The steps behind were filled with those who had been inside.
We're all together,
someone called as the crowd closed in.
Clear the streets, the officer ordered.
That's what we're doing, someone called from back in the crowd.
Mahoney, he bellowed to another policeman. Send in a riot call. What riot?
One of the white men called to him.
There's no riot.
If I say there's a riot, the officer said. And what are you white people doing up here in Harlem?
We're citizens. We go anywhere we like. Listen, here comes some more cops, someone called. Let him come! Let the commissioner come!
It became too much for me. The whole thing had gotten out of hand. What had I said to bring on all this? I edged to the back of the crowd on the steps and backed into the hallway. Where would I go? I hurried up to the old couple's apartment. But I can't hide here, I thought, heading back for the stairs.
No, you can't go that way, a voice said. I whirled. It was a white girl standing in the door.
What are you doing in here? I shouted, my fear turning to feverish anger.
I didn't mean to startle you, she said. Brother, that was quite a speech you made. I just heard the end of it, but you certainly moved them to action.
Action, I said.
Action? Don't be modest, brother, she said. I heard you.
Look, miss, we'd better get out of here, I said, finally controlling the throbbing in my throat. There are a lot of policemen downstairs and more coming.
Oh, yes. You'd better go over the roof, she said. Otherwise, someone is sure to point you out.
Over the roof?
It's easy. You just go up to the roof of the building and keep crossing until you reach the house at the end of the block. Then open the door and walk down as though you've been visiting. You'd better hurry. The longer you remain unknown to the police, the longer you'll be effective.
Effective, I thought. What does she mean? And what was this brother business?
Thanks, I said, and hurried for the stairs. Goodbye.
Her voice rose fluidly behind me. I turned, glimpsing her white face in the dim light of the darkened doorway. I took the flight in a bound, and cautiously opened the door, and suddenly the sun flared bright on the roof, and it was windy cold. Before me, the low, snow-caked walls dividing the buildings stretched hurdle-like the long length of the block to the corner, and before me, empty clotheslines trembled in the wind. I made my way through the wind-carved snow to the next roof, and then to the next, going with swift caution. Planes were rising over an airfield far to the southeast, and I was running now, and seeing all the church steeples rising and falling, and stacks with smoke leaning sharp against the sky, and below in the street, the sound of sirens and shouting. I hurried. Then climbing over a wall, I looked back, seeing a man hurrying after me,
slipping, sliding, going over the low dividing walls of the roofs with puffing, bustling effort. I turned and ran, trying to put the rows of chimneys between us, wondering why he didn't yell, halt, or shout, or shoot. I ran, dodging behind an elevator housing, then dashing to the next roof, going down, snow cold to my hands, knees striking, toes gripping, and up, and running, and looking back, seeing the short figure in black still running after. The corner seemed a mile away. I tried to count the number of roofs that bounced before me yet to be crossed. Getting to 7, I ran, hearing shouts, more sirens, and looking back, and him still behind me, running in a short-legged scramble, still behind me as I tried to open the door of a building to go down, and finding it stuck, and running once more, trying to zigzag in the snow, and feeling the crunch of gravel underneath, and behind me still, as I swung over a partition, and when brushing past a huge coat and arousing a flight of frantic white birds, suddenly as large as buzzards as they beat furiously against my eyes, dazzling the sun as they fluttered up and away and around in a furious glide, and me running again and looking back, and for a split second, thinking him gone and once more seeing him bobbing after. Why doesn't he shoot? Why? If only it were like at home, where I knew someone in all the houses, knew them by sight and by name, by blood and by background, by shame and pride and by religion. It was a carpeted hall, and I moved down with pounding heart as a dog set up a terrific din within the top apartment. Then I moved quickly, my body like glass inside as I skipped downward off the edges of the stairs. Looking down the stairwell, I saw pale light filtering through the door glass far below. But what had happened to the girl? Had she put the man on my trail? What was she doing there? I bounded down, no one challenging me, and I stopped in the vestibule, breathing deeply and listening for his hand upon the door above and brushing my clothing into order. Then I stepped into the street with a nonchalance copied from characters I'd seen in the movies. No sound from above, not even the malicious note of the barking dog. It was a long block, and I had come down into a building that faced not the street but the avenue. A squad of mounted policemen lashed themselves around the corner and galloped past, the horseshoes thudding dully through the snow, the men rising high in their saddles, shouting. I picked up speed, careful not to run, heading away. This was awful. What on earth had I said to have brought on all this? How would it end? Someone might be killed. Heads would be pistol-whipped. I stopped at the corner looking for the pursuing man, the detective, and for a bus. The long white stretch of street was empty, the aroused pigeons still circling overhead. I scanned the roofs, expecting to see him peering down. The sound of shouting continued to rise, then another green and white patrol car was whining around the corner and speeding past me, heading for the block. I cut through a block in which there were close to a dozen funeral parlors, each decked out with neon signs, all set up in old brownstone buildings. Elaborate funeral cars stood along the curb, one a dull black with windows shaped like Gothic arches, through which I saw funeral flowers piled upon a casket. I hurried on. I could see the girl's face still, below the short flight of stairs. But who was the figure that had crossed the roof behind me, chased me? Why had he been so silent, and why was there only one? Yes, and why hadn't they sent a patrol car to pick me up? I hurried out of the block of funeral parlors into the bright sun that swept the snow of the avenue, slowing to a leisurely walk now, trying to give the impression of a complete lack of haste. I longed to look stupid, utterly incapable of thought or speech, and tried to shuffle my feet over the walk, but quit with distaste after stealing a glance behind me. Just ahead I saw a car pull up, and a man leap out with a physician's bag. "Hurry, doctor," a man called from the stoop. "She's already in labor." "Good," the doctor called. "That's what we've been waiting for, isn't it?"
"Yeah, but it didn't start when we expected it."
I watched them disappear inside the hall. What a hell of a time to be born, I thought. At the corner, I joined several people waiting for the lights to change.
I just about convinced myself that I had escaped successfully when a quiet, penetrating voice beside me said, "That was a masterful bit of persuasion, brother." Suddenly, wound tight as a tension spring, I turned almost lethargically. A short, insignificant-looking, bushy-eyebrowed man with a quiet smile on his face stood beside me, looking not at all like a policeman. "What do you mean?" I asked, my voice lazy, distant.
"Don't be alarmed," he said. "I'm a friend." "I've got nothing to be alarmed about, and you're no friend of mine." "Then say that, I'm an admirer," he said pleasantly.
"Admirer? Of what?"
"Of your speech," he said. "I was listening."
"What speech?" "I made no speech," I said. He smiled knowingly.
"I can see that you've been well trained. Come, it isn't good for you to be seen with me here in the street. Let's go somewhere, for a cup of coffee." Something told me to refuse, but I was intrigued and, underneath it all, was probably flattered. Besides, if I refused to go, it would be taken as an admission of guilt. And he didn't look like a policeman or a detective. I went silently beside him to a cafeteria down near the end of the block, seeing him peer inside through the window before we entered. "You get the table, brother, over there near the wall where we can talk in peace. I'll go get the coffee." I watched him go across the floor with a bouncy, rolling step, then found a table and sat, watching him. It was warm in the cafeteria. It was late afternoon now, and only a few customers were scattered at the tables. I watched the man going familiarly to the food counter and ordering. His movements as he peered through the brightly lighted shelves of pastry were those of a lively, small animal, a fice, interested in detecting only the target cut of cake. So he's heard my speech. Well, I'll hear what he has to say, I thought, seeing him start toward me with his rapid, rolling, bouncy, heel and toey step. It was as though he had taught himself to walk that way, and I had a feeling that somehow he was acting a part, that something about him wasn't exactly real, an idea which I dismissed immediately since there was a quality of unreality over the whole afternoon. He came straight to the table without having to look about for me, as though he had expected me to take that particular table and no other, although many tables were vacant. He was balancing a plate of cake on top of each cup, setting them down deftly and shoving one toward me as he took his chair. "I thought you might like a piece of cheesecake," he said.
"Cheesecake," I said. "I've never heard of it."
"It's nice. Sugar?"
"Go ahead," I said.
"No, after you, brother."
I looked at him, then poured three spoonfuls and shoved the shaker toward him. I was tense again. "Thanks," I said, repressing an impulse to call him down about the brother business. He smiled, cutting into his cheesecake with a fork and shoving far too large a piece into his mouth. His manners are extremely crude, I thought, trying to put him at a disadvantage in my own mind by pointedly taking a small piece of the cheesy stuff and placing it neatly into my mouth.
"You know," he said, taking a gulp of coffee, "I haven't heard such an effective piece of eloquence since the days when I was in, well, in a long time. You aroused them so quickly to action. I don't understand how you managed it. If only some of our speakers could have listened. With a few words, you had them involved in action. Others would have still been wasting time with empty verbiage. I want to thank you for a most instructive experience."
I drank my coffee silently. Not only did I distrust him, I didn't know how much I could safely say.
"The cheesecake here is good," he said before I could answer. "It's really very good. By the way, where did you learn to speak?"
"Nowhere," I said much too quickly.
"Then you're very talented. You're a natural. It's hard to believe."
"I was simply angry," I said, deciding to admit this much in order to see what he would reveal.
"Then your anger was skillfully controlled. It had eloquence."
"Why was that?"
"Why? I suppose I felt sorry. I don't know. Maybe I just felt like making a speech. There was the crowd waiting, so I said a few words. You might not believe it, but I didn't know what I was going to say."
"Please," he said, with a knowing smile. "What do you mean?" I said.
"You try to sound cynical, but I see through you. I know. I listened very carefully to what you had to say. You were enormously moved. Your emotions were touched.
I guess so, I said. Maybe seeing them reminded me of something. He leaned forward, watching me intensely now, the smile still on his lips. Did it remind you of people you know? I guess it did, I said. I think I understand. You were watching a death. I dropped my fork. No one was killed, I said tensely. What are you trying to do? A death on the city pavements. That's the title of a detective story or something I read somewhere. He laughed. I only mean, metaphorically speaking. They're living but dead, dead in living, a unity of opposites. Oh, I said, what kind of double talk was this? The old one. They're agrarian types, you know. Being ground up by industrial conditions, thrown on the dump heaps and cast aside. You pointed it out very well. 87 years and nothing to show for it, you said. You were absolutely correct. I suppose that seeing them like that made me feel pretty bad, I said. Yes, of course. And you made an effective speech. But you mustn't waste your emotions on individuals. They don't count. Who doesn't count, I said. Those old ones, he said grimly. It's sad, yes, but they're already dead, defunct. History has passed them by. Unfortunate, but there's nothing to do about them. They're like dead limbs that must be pruned away so that the tree may bear young fruit, or the storms of history will blow them down anyway. Better the storm should hit them. But look, no, let me continue. These people are old. Men grow old, and types of men grow old, and these are very old. All they have left is their religion. That's all they can think about. So they'll be cast aside. They're dead. You see? Because they're incapable of rising to the necessity of the historical situation. But I like them, I said. I like them. They reminded me of folks I know down south. It's taken me a long time to feel it. But they're folks just like me, except that I've been to school a few years. He wagged his round red head. Oh, no, brother, you're mistaken and you're sentimental. You're not like them. Perhaps you were, but you're not any longer. Otherwise, you'd never have made that speech. Perhaps you were, but that's all past, dead. You might not recognize it just now, but that part of you is dead. You have not completely shed that self, that old agrarian self, but it's dead, and you will throw it off completely and emerge something new. History has been born in your brain. Look, I said, I don't know what you're talking about. I've never lived on a farm. I didn't study agriculture. But I do know why I made that speech. Then why? Because I was upset over seeing those old folks put out in the street. That's why. I don't care what you call it. I was angry. He shrugged. Well, let's not argue about it, he said. I've a notion that you could do it again. Perhaps you would be interested in working for us. For whom? I asked, suddenly excited. What was he trying to do? With our organization. We need a good speaker for this district. Someone who can articulate the grievances of the people, he said. But nobody cares about their grievances, I said. Suppose they were articulated. Who would listen or care? They exist, he said with his knowing smile. They exist. And when the cry of protest is sounded, there are those who will hear it and act. There was something mysterious and smug in the way he spoke, as though he had everything figured out, whatever he was talking about. Look at this very most certain white man, I thought. He didn't even realize that I was afraid, and yet he speaks so confidently. I got to my feet. I'm sorry, I said. I have a job, and I'm not interested in anyone's grievances but my own. But you are concerned with that old couple, he said with narrowed eyes. Are they relatives of yours? Sure. We're both black, I said, beginning to laugh. He smiled, his eyes intense upon my face. Seriously, are they your relatives? Sure. We were burned in the same oven, I said. The effect was electric. Why do you fellows always talk in terms of race? He snapped, his eyes blazing. What other terms do you know? I said, puzzled.
You think I would have been around there if they had been white?
He threw up his hands and laughed.
Well, let's not argue that now, he said. You were very effective in helping them. I can't believe that you're such an individualist as you pretend. You appear to be a man who knew his duty toward the people and performed it well. Whatever you think about it, personally, you are a spokesman for your people, and you have a duty to work in their interest. It was too complicated for me. Look, my friend, thanks for the coffee and cake. I have no more interest in those old folks than in your job. I wanted to make a speech. I like to make speeches. What happened afterwards is a mystery to me. You picked the wrong man. You should have stopped one of those fellows who started yelling at the policeman. I stood up. Wait a second, he said, producing a piece of envelope and scribbling something. You might change your mind. As for those others, I know them already. I looked at the white paper in his extended hand. You were wise to distrust me, he said. You don't know who I am, and you don't trust me. That's as it should be. But I don't give up hope, because someday you will look me up on your own accord, and it will be different. For then you'll be ready. Just call this number and ask for Brother Jack. You needn't give me your name, just mention our conversation. Should you decide tonight, give me a ring about 8.
Okay, I said, taking the paper. I doubt if I'll ever need it, but who knows?
Well, you think about it, brother. Times are grave, and you seem very indignant.
I only wanted to make a speech, I said again. But you were indignant,
and sometimes the difference between individual and organized indignation is the difference between criminal and political action, he said.
I laughed. So what? I'm neither a criminal nor a politician, brother. So you picked the wrong man. But thanks again for the coffee and cheesecake, brother.
I left him sitting with a quiet smile on his face.
When I had crossed the avenue, I looked through the glass, seeing him still there. And it occurred to me that he was the same man who had followed me over the roof. He hadn't been chasing me at all, but only going in the same direction. I hadn't understood much of what he had said, only that he had spoken with great confidence. Anyway, I had been the better runner. Perhaps it was a trick of some kind. He gave the impression that he understood much and spoke out of a knowledge far deeper than appeared on the surface of his words. Perhaps it was only the knowledge that he had escaped by the same route as I. But what had he to fear? I had made the speech, not he. That girl in the apartment had said that the longer I remained unseen, the longer I'd be effective, which didn't make much sense either. But perhaps that was why he had run. He wanted to remain unseen and effective.
Effective at what?
No doubt he was laughing at me. I must have looked silly, hurtling across the roofs and like a black-faced comedian shrinking from a ghost when the white pigeons shot up around me. To hell with him. He needn't be so smug. I knew of some things he didn't know. Let him find someone else. He only wanted to use me for something. Everybody wanted to use you for some purpose. Why should he want me as a speaker? Let him make his own speeches. I headed for home, feeling a growing satisfaction that I had dismissed him so completely. It was turning dark now and much colder. Colder than I had ever known. What on earth was it, I mused, bending my head to the wind, that made us leave the warm, mild weather of home for all this cold and never to return? If not something worth hoping for, freezing for, even being evicted for. I felt sad. An old woman passed, bent down with 2 shopping bags, her eyes upon the slushy walk, and I thought of the old couple at the eviction. How had it ended, and where were they now? What an awful emotion. What had he called it? A death on the city pavements. How often did such things occur? And what would he say of Mary
She was far from dead or being ground to bits by New York. Hell, she knew very well how to live here, much better than I was, with my college training. Training? Bledsoeing, that was the term. And I was the one being ground up, not Mary. Thinking of her made me feel better. I couldn't imagine Mary being as helpless as the old woman at the eviction. And by the time I reached the apartment, I had begun to lose my depression. The odor of Mary's cabbage changed my mind. Standing engulfed in the fumes filling the hallway, it struck me that I couldn't realistically reject the job. Cabbage was always a depressing reminder of the leaner years of my childhood, and I suffered silently whenever she served it. But this was the third time within the week, and it dawned on me that Mary must be short of money. And here I've been congratulating myself for refusing a job, I thought, when I don't even know how much money I owe her. I felt a quick sickness grow within me. How could I face her? I went quietly to my room and lay upon the bed, brooding. There were other roomers who had jobs, and I knew she received help from relatives. Still, there was no mistake. Mary loved a variety of food, and this concentration upon cabbage was no accident. Why hadn't I noticed? Oh, she'd been too kind, never dunning me, and I lay there, hearing her, "Don't come bothering me with your little troubles, boy. You'll get something by and by," when I would try to apologize for not paying my rent and board. Perhaps another roomer had moved or lost his job. What were Mary's problems anyway? Who articulated her grievances, as the red-headed man had put it? She had kept me going for months, yet I had no idea. What kind of man was I becoming? I had taken her so much for granted that I hadn't even thought of my debt when I refused the job. Nor had I considered the embarrassment I might have caused her should the police come to her home to arrest me for making that wild speech. Suddenly I felt an urge to go look at her. Perhaps I had really never seen her. I had been acting like a child, not a man. Taking out the crumpled paper, I looked at the telephone number. He had mentioned an organization. What was it called? I hadn't inquired. What a fool. At least I should have learned what I was turning down, although I distrusted the red-headed man. Had I refused out of a fear as well as from resentment? Why didn't he just tell me what it was all about, instead of trying to impress me with his knowledge? Then from down the hall I could hear Mary singing, her voice clear and untroubled, though she sang a troubled song. It was Backwater Blues. I lay listening as the sound flowed to and around me, bringing me a calm sense of my indebtedness. When it faded, I got up and put on my coat. Perhaps it was not too late. I would find a telephone and call him. Then he could tell me exactly what he wanted, and I could make a sensible decision. Mary heard me this time. "Boy, when you come home," she said, sticking her head out of the kitchen. "I didn't even hear you."
"I came in a short while ago," I said. "You were busy, so I didn't bother you."
"Then where you going so soon? Ain't you going to eat supper?"
"Yes, Mary," I said, "but I've got to go out now. I forgot to take care of some business."
"Shucks, what kind of business you got on a cold night like this?" she said.
"Oh, I don't know. I might have a surprise for you."
"Won't nothing surprise me," she said. "And you hurry on back here and get something hot in your stomach."
Going through the cold, seeking a telephone booth, I realized that I had committed myself to bring her some kind of surprise. And as I walked, I became mildly enthusiastic. It was, after all, a job that promised to exercise my talent for public speaking. And if the pay was anything at all, it would be more than I had now. At least I could pay Mary something of what I owed her, and she might receive some satisfaction that her prediction had proved correct. I seemed to be haunted by cabbage fumes. The little luncheonette in which I found the telephone was reeking. Brother Jack didn't sound at all surprised upon receiving my call.
"I'd like some information about—" "Get here as quickly as you can. We're leaving shortly," he said.
giving me a Lenox Avenue address and hanging up before I could finish my request. I went out into the cold, annoyed both by his lack of surprise and by the short, clipped manner in which he'd spoken. But I started out, taking my own time. It wasn't far, and just as I reached the corner of Lenox, a car pulled up and I saw several men inside, Jack among them, smiling. "Get in," he said. "We can talk where we're going. It's a party. You might like it." "But I'm not dressed," I said. I'll call you tomorrow." "Dressed," he chuckled. "You're all right. Get in." I got in beside him and the driver, noticing that there were three men in the back. Then the car moved off. No one spoke. Brother Jack seemed to sink immediately into deep thought. The others looked out into the night. It was as though we were mere chance passengers in a subway car. I felt uneasy, wondering where we were going, but decided to say nothing. The car shot swiftly over the slush. Looking out at the passing night, I wondered what kind of men they were. Certainly they didn't act as though they were heading for a very sociable evening. I was hungry, and I wouldn't get back in time for supper. Well, maybe it would be worth it, both to Mary and to me. At least I wouldn't have to eat that cabbage. For a moment the car paused for the traffic light. Then we were circling swiftly through long stretches of snow-covered landscape, lighted here and there by street lamps and the nervously stabbing beams of passing cars. We were flashing through Central Park, now completely transformed by the snow. It was as though we had plunged suddenly into mid-country peace. Yet I knew that here, somewhere close by in the night, there was a zoo with its dangerous animals, the lions and tigers in heated cages, the bears asleep, the snakes coiled tightly underground. And there was also the reservoir of dark water, all covered by snow and by night, by snowfall and by nightfall, buried beneath black and white, gray mist and gray silence. Then past the driver's head I could see a wall of buildings looming beyond the windshield. The car nosed slowly into traffic, dropped swiftly down a hill. We stopped before an expensive-looking building in a strange part of the city. I could see the word Thonian on the storm awning stretched above the walk as I got out with the others and went swiftly toward a lobby lighted by dim bulbs set behind frosted glass, going past the uniformed doorman with an uncanny sense of familiarity. Feeling now, as we entered a soundproof elevator and shot away at a mile a minute, that I had been through it all before. Then we were stopping, with a gentle bounce, and I was uncertain whether we had gone up or down. Brother Jack guided me down the hall to a door on which I saw a bronze door knocker in the shape of a large-eyed owl. Now he hesitated a moment, his head thrust forward as though listening. Then his hand covered the owl from view, producing instead of the knock which I expected, an icy peal of clear chimes. Shortly the door swung partly open, revealing a smartly dressed woman, whose hard, handsome face broke into smiles. "Come in, brothers," she said, her exotic perfume filling the foyer. I noticed a clip of blazing diamonds on her dress as I tried to stand aside for the others, but Brother Jack pushed me ahead. "Excuse me," I said, but she held her ground, and I was pressing tensely against her perfumed softness, seeing her smile as though there were only she and I. Then I was passed, disturbed not so much by the close contact as by the sense that I had somehow been through it all before. I couldn't decide if it were from watching some similar scene in the movies, from books I'd read, or from some recurrent but deeply buried dream. Whatsoever, it was like entering a scene which, because of some devious circumstance, I had hitherto watched only from a distance. How could they have such an expensive place, I wondered. "Put your things in the study," the woman said. "I'll go see about drinks." We entered a room lined with books and decorated with old musical instruments. An Irish harp, a hunter's horn, a clarinet, and a wooden flute were suspended by the neck from the wall on pink and blue ribbons. There were a leather divan and a number of easy chairs.
Throw your coat on the divan, Brother Jack said. I slid out of my overcoat and looked around. The dial of the radio, built into a section of the natural mahogany bookshelf, was lighted, but I couldn't hear any sound. And there was an ample desk on which rested silver and crystal writing things, and, as one of the men came to stand gazing at the bookcase, I was struck by the contrast between the richness of the room and their rather poor clothing.
Now we'll go into the other room, Brother Jack said, taking me by the arm.
We entered a large room in which one entire wall was hung with Italian red draperies that fell in rich folds from the ceiling. A number of well-dressed men and women were gathered in groups, some beside a grand piano, the others lounging in the pale beige upholstery of the blonde wood chairs. Here and there I saw several attractive young women, but carefully avoided giving them more than a glance. I felt extremely uncomfortable, although after brief glances no one paid me any special attention. It was as though they hadn't seen me, as though I were here, and yet not here. The others were moving away to join the various groups now, and Brother Jack took my arm.
Come, let's get a drink, he said, guiding me toward the end of the room.
The woman who'd let us in was mixing drinks behind a handsome free-form bar, which was large enough to have graced a nightclub.
How about a drink for us, Emma? Brother Jack said.
Well, now, I'll have to think about it, she said, tilting her severely drawn head and smiling.
Don't think. Act, he said. We're very thirsty men. This young man pushed history ahead 20 years today.
Oh, she said, her eyes becoming intent. You must tell me about him.
Just read the morning papers, Emma. Things have begun to move. Yes, leap ahead.
He laughed deeply. What would you like, brother? She said, her eyes brushing slowly over my face.
Bourbon, I said a little too loudly as I remembered the best the South had to offer.
My face was warm, but I returned her glance as steadily as I dared. It was not the harsh, uninterested in you as a human being stare that I'd known in the South, the kind that swept over a black man as though he were a horse or an insect. It was something more, a direct, what type of mere man have we here kind of look that seemed to go beneath my skin. Somewhere in my leg a muscle twitched violently.
Emma, the bourbon. Two bourbons, Brother Jack said.
You know, she said, picking up a decanter, I'm intrigued.
Naturally. Always, he said. Intrigued and intriguing. But we're dying of thirst.
Only of impatience, she said, pouring the drinks. I mean, you are. Tell me, where did you find this young hero of the people?
I didn't, Brother Jack said. He simply arose out of a crowd. The people always throw up their leaders, you know.
Throw them up, she said. Nonsense. They chew them up and spit them out. The leaders are made, not born. Then they're destroyed. You've always said that. Here you are, brother.
He looked at her steadily. I took the heavy crystal glass and raised it to my lips, glad for an excuse to turn from her eyes. A haze of cigarette smoke drifted through the room. I heard a series of rich arpeggios sound on the piano behind me, and turned to look, hearing the woman Emma say, not quite softly enough,
"But don't you think he should be a little blacker?"
"Shh! Don't be a damn fool," Brother Jack said sharply. "We're not interested in his looks, but in his voice, and I suggest, Emma, that you make it your interest, too."
Suddenly, hot and breathless, I saw a window across the room and went over and stood looking out. We were up, very high. Street lamps and traffic cut patterns in the night below. So, she doesn't think I'm black enough. What does she want, a black-faced comedian? Who is she, anyway, Brother Jack's wife, his girlfriend? Maybe she wants to see me sweat coal tar, ink, shoe polish, graphite. What was I, a man or a natural resource? The window was so high that I could barely hear the sound of traffic below. This was a bad beginning, but hell, I was being hired by Brother Jack if he still wanted me, not this Emma woman. I'd like to show her how really black I am, I thought, taking a big drink of the bourbon. It was smooth and cold.
I'd have to be careful with the stuff. Anything might happen if I had too much. With these people, I'll have to be careful. Always careful. With all people, I'll have to be careful.
It's a pleasant view, isn't it?
A voice said. I whirled to see a tall, dark man.
But now, would you mind joining us in the library? He said.
Brother Jack, the men who had come along in the car, and two others, whom I hadn't seen before, were waiting.
Come in, brother, Jack said. Business before pleasure is always a good rule, whoever you are. Some day the rule shall be business with pleasure, for the joy of labor shall have been restored. Sit down.
I took the chair directly before him, wondering what this speech was all about.
You know, brother, he said, we don't ordinarily interrupt our social gatherings with business, but with you it's necessary.
I'm very sorry, I said. I should have called you earlier.
Sorry? Why, we're only too glad to do so. We've been waiting for you for months, or for someone who could do what you've done.
But what, I said,
what are we doing? What is our mission?
It's simple. We are working for a better world for all people. It's that simple. Too many have been dispossessed of their heritage, and we have banded together in brotherhood so as to do something about it.
What do you think of that?
Why, I think it's fine, I said, trying to take in the full meaning of his words.
I think it's excellent.
But how?
By moving them to action, just as you did this morning. Brothers, I was there, he said to the others, and he was magnificent. With a few words, he set off an effective demonstration against evictions.
I was present, too, another said. It was amazing.
Tell us something of your background, Brother Jack said, his voice and manner demanding truthful answers. And I explained briefly that I had come up looking for work to pay my way through college and had failed.
Do you still plan to return?
Not now, I said. I'm all done with that.
It's just as well, Brother Jack said. You have little to learn down there. However, college training is not a bad thing, although you'll have to forget most of it. Did you study economics?
Some.
Sociology?
Yes.
Well, let me advise you to forget it. You'll be given books to read along with some material that explains our program in detail. But we're moving too fast. Perhaps you aren't interested in working for the Brotherhood.
But you haven't told me what I'm supposed to do, I said.
He looked at me fixedly, picking up his glass slowly and taking a long swallow. Let's put it this way, he said. How would you like to be the new Booker T. Washington?
What? I looked into his bland eyes for laughter, seeing his red head turned slightly to the side. Please now, I said,
oh, yes. I'm serious.
Then I don't understand you.
Was I drunk? I looked at him. He seemed sober. What do you think of the idea? Or better still, what do you think of Booker T. Washington?
Why, naturally, I think he was an important figure. At least, most people say so.
But,
well, I was at a loss for words. He was going too fast again. The whole idea was insane, and yet the others were looking at me calmly. One of them was lighting up an underslung pipe. The match sputtered, caught fire.
What is it? Brother Jack insisted.
Well, I guess I don't think he was as great as the founder.
Oh. And why not?
Well, in the first place, the founder came before him and did practically everything Booker T. Washington did and a lot more. And more people believed in him. You hear a lot of arguments about Booker T. Washington, but few would argue about the founder.
No. But perhaps that is because the founder lies outside history, while Washington is still a living force. However, the new Washington shall work for the poor.
I looked into my crystal glass of bourbon. It was unbelievable, yet strangely exciting, and I had the sense of being present at the creation of important events, as though a curtain had been parted and I was being allowed to glimpse how the country operated. And yet none of these men was well known, or at least I'd never seen their faces in the newspapers. During these times of indecision, when all the old answers are proven false, the people look back to the dead to give them a clue, he went on. They call first upon one, and then upon another of those who have acted in the past.
If you please, brother, the man with the pipe interrupted, I think you should speak more concretely.
Please, don't interrupt, Brother Jack said icily.
I wish only to point out that a scientific terminology exists, the man said, emphasizing his words with his pipe. After all, we call ourselves scientists here. Let us speak as scientists.
In due time, Brother Jack said, in due time. You see, brother, he said, turning to me, the trouble is that there is little the dead can do, otherwise they wouldn't be the dead. No, but on the other hand, it would be a great mistake to assume that the dead are absolutely powerless. They are powerless only to give the full answer to the new questions posed for the living by history, but they try. Whenever they hear the imperious cries of the people in a crisis, the dead respond. Right now, in this country, with its many national groups, all the old heroes are being called back to life. Jefferson, Jackson, Pulaski, Garibaldi, Booker T. Washington, Sun Yat-sen, Danny O'Connell, Abraham Lincoln, and countless others are being asked to step once again upon the stage of history. I can't say too emphatically that we stand at a terminal point in history, at a moment of supreme world crisis. Destruction lies ahead unless things are changed, and things must be changed, and changed by the people. Because, brother, the enemies of man are dispossessing the world. Do you understand? I'm beginning to, I said, greatly impressed. There are other terms, other more accurate ways of saying all of this, but we haven't time for that right now. We speak now in terms that are easy to understand, as you spoke to the crowd this morning. I see, I said, feeling uncomfortable under his stare. So, it isn't a matter of whether you wish to be the new Booker T. Washington, my friend. Booker Washington was resurrected today at a certain eviction in Harlem. He came out from the anonymity of the crowd and spoke to the people. So you see, I don't joke with you or play with words either. There is a scientific explanation for this phenomenon, as our learned brother has graciously reminded me. You'll learn it in time, but whatever you call it, the reality of the world crisis is a fact. We are all realists here, and materialists. It is a question of who shall determine the direction of events. That is why we've brought you into this room. This morning, you answer the people's appeal, and we want you to be the true interpreter of the people. You shall be the new Booker T. Washington, but even greater than he. There was silence. I could hear the wet cracking of the pipe. Perhaps we should allow the brother to express himself as to how he feels about all this, the man with the pipe said.
Well, brother, Brother Jack said. I looked into the waiting faces.
It's all so new to me that I don't know exactly what I do think, I said. Do you really think you have the right man?
You mustn't let that worry you, Brother Jack said. You will rise to the task. It is only necessary that you work hard and follow instructions.
They stood up now. I looked at them, fighting a sense of unreality. They stared at me as the fellows had done when I was being initiated into my college fraternity. Only this was real, and now was the time for me to decide or to say I thought they were crazy and go back to Mary's. But what is there to lose, I thought. At least they've invited me, one of us, in at the beginning of something big. And besides, if I refused to join them, where would I go? To a job as a porter at the railroad station? At least here was a chance to speak.
When shall I start? I said.
Tomorrow. We must waste no time. And by the way, where are you living?
I rent a room from a woman in Harlem, I said. A housewife?